From the studios of WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. The onset of Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia can be one of the more terrifying aspects of growing older. While the risk of cognitive impairment increases with age, it is not considered a normal part of the aging process. The current Alzheimer's epidemic will be completely unaffordable in the coming decades, according to a report from the Alzheimer's Association, released earlier this year. The report projects that Medicare and Medicaid costs linked to people with Alzheimer's will more than double by 2030. Costs will almost quintuple by 2050 to $1.1 trillion. That would be up from the current $226 billion projected to be spent this year. Continuing on that trajectory, according to the association, would bankrupt the Medicare system. The lack of a cure in the face of the exponential increases in spending on the disease is causing some members of Congress to look for ways to ramp up funding on research. And although there is not yet a cure, there are innovative screening processes and worthwhile treatments. Today, we'll learn about some of the signs of Alzheimer's disease. We'll also explore why some experts advocate for screening after a certain age. Joining us in studio today, Dr. Julian Keith is a professor of psychology at UNCW and a founder of the Mars Memory Health Network. Julian Keith, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you.
Also with us today, Dr. Len Leche is a professor of psychology at UNCW as well, and the director of clinical services at the Mars Memory Health Network. He is also one of the founders of that clinic. Len Leche, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
If you have a question about memory health, send us an email at coastline@whqr.org. You can also give us a call at 910-343-1138 or tweet us at coastlinehqr. Len Leche, what are the signs of Alzheimer's disease?
Well, there's a number of sort of hallmark features that you see. Obviously, the rapid forgetting of information is probably the classic sign. So these individuals who, when they're exposed to something after a very brief period of time, there's virtually amnestic, no recollection of all of it having been conveyed to them. That, of course, you tend to see in the more moderate and advanced stages. Other things that will occur, word-finding problems that come along with memory difficulties, takes greater difficulty doing daily functioning, and so it will interfere with their ability to just complete the kinds of tasks that you and I would take for granted, getting lost in familiar places, even losing the ability to understand how to use things that you previously were able to use. So there might be some type of equipment that you'd been comfortable using, a VCR or something of that nature, that you forget how to do that.
And so you're talking about symptoms that you could observe, but at this point the disease is going to be somewhat advanced.
Correct.
Is there a difference between, I'm sure people are listening right now and thinking, oh goodness, I've done some absent-minded things like left the keys in the front door lock and walked in the house and forgotten, or walked into a room and forgot why, or couldn't remember a person's name that I knew. Is that a sign of Alzheimer's disease?
And it's important to recognize that failures of memory occur all the time. Normally functioning individuals, failures of memory occur all the time. And unfortunately, this is one of the things that makes it a particular challenge to diagnose something early. Most people, even a non-memory expert, could diagnose or get a good estimate of someone who is far in advanced stage of dementia, the Alzheimer's type. In the earliest stages, even the preclinical stages, it becomes much more difficult to differentiate that from kind of everyday forgetfulness. Usually the difference is that inattentiveness is probably the main reason why people have problems of the day-to-day nature that you mentioned, is they're focused on something else. But the end product often looks very much the same in the sense that you've forgotten something or you appear to have forgotten it. And the reality is you didn't attend to it to begin with closely enough. And so it didn't get in there in order to be forgotten. And that's the marked difference.
The two of you, you founded Mars Memory Health Network a little more than 10 years ago.
Yes.
Julian Keith, why did you begin this clinic? What is its purpose?
I should also add that Dale Cohen is a partner in this as well. He's a professor at UNCW as well in psychology.
And the three of you founded it together.
The three of us did it together. The reason we did it is that we saw the kinds of issues that you said in the front piece to this episode, the rising incidence of Alzheimer's, the rising cost, the fact that it was a problem that's going to have to be addressed, or else we're going to all be in trouble. And we realized that one of the fundamental challenges was doing early detection, that many of the attempts to manage the disease were strategies that were coming in late, coming in after the person had already suffered devastating brain damage from the disease, and treatments were being delivered late. And
after, at the point, as Len mentioned earlier, that you're seeing someone get lost in a neighborhood in which they've lived for years, or advanced stages.
Correct. When the decline is so severe that it's already accompanied by severe memory or severe brain damage. So our strategy was to try to come up with a way of detecting the disease process early. And over the last decade, that's become a more prevalent strategy. In fact, I would say that the field has moved toward that now. When we first started doing it, we were the first in on doing that. And thankfully, the rest of the field has come that direction too.
And are you talking about from a national perspective? Nationally, you were ahead of the leading the charge on that front.
Particularly people who are in the treatment development realm, they're realizing that if you're going to have effective treatments, they're going to have to be delivered before there's so much injury to the brain that it's irreversible. And so you see all the pharma companies now trying to come in early and develop treatments that can intervene before there's a lot of brain damage. You see people who are developing other strategies, like preventive strategies and early intervention strategies with dietary and lifestyle changes, recognizing that the strategy has to be to get the person in early. So we're proud to have been on the cutting edge of that.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about Alzheimer's disease, what the risk factors are, why some experts recommend screening, and what new breakthroughs might be on the horizon. Here in the studio to answer your questions are Dr. Julian Keith and Dr. Len Leche. Both men are founders of the Mars Memory Health Network in Wilmington. They're also both professors of psychology at UNCW. If you have a question about Alzheimer's disease, or if you have a loved one who struggled with it, give us a call at 910-343-1138 and share your experience or ask your question. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org or tweet us using coastlinehqr. At this point, what do we know about what causes Alzheimer's?
There's debate about the causes. We know that there are certain markers. So there's always going to be beta amyloid accumulating. That's a protein that has normal functions in brain health, but it accumulates in abnormal ways in the brains of people with Alzheimer's. We also know that tau proteins, which are these little proteins inside of neurons that carry out a couple of special functions. One is building the microtubules, the little tubes inside the neurons that support their structure, and also create the pathways for things to move back and forth inside of the cells. The tau proteins that make those up start deteriorating in people with Alzheimer's. So we know that those are crucial factors. You also start losing connections between neurons. So some people think that the disease starts with a rapid loss of connections between neurons, and that starts escalating into the rest of the disease process that you see with the tau proteins breaking down and the beta amyloid accumulating. But the debate is which comes first, what's going on there. So.
Just yesterday, the Journal of Clinical Investigation published new research linking diabetes and Alzheimer's. And this is something that we've heard about before. The study shows that elevated levels of blood sugar contribute to increased levels of amyloid beta. What does that mean?
Well, there's a couple of things that underlie that finding. I mean, we do know that some of the major risk factors for developing dementia of the Alzheimer's type include diabetes, high cholesterol, blood pressure, basically the same things that are risk factors for problems with the heart are also the risk factors for problems with the brain. So, and that is something that we often talk about is, you know, maximizing your sort of heart health is a great way to also attempt to maximize your brain health. But yes, those risk factors tend to be very much the same. And so, the link with diabetes is one that has been demonstrated several times in different ways. And it's one of the reasons why, some of the lifestyle factors are also very important here in terms of resulting in being risk factors for you if you're on the wrong side of those lifestyle factors, or being, in a sense, preventative type, or at least decreasing your risk factors. And we're talking about things like diet and exercise. And again, the same kinds of things you would do to treat a diabetic condition can be used to essentially forestall or decrease your chance of developing cognitive problems like dementia of the Alzheimer's type.
And when we're talking about dementia of the Alzheimer's type, are there other types of aging-related dementia that are not Alzheimer's?
Yes, there are actually many different types of dementia. So dementia is the sort of the broad category. Alzheimer's is the most common of those dementias, and it has a kind of particular unusual course in the sense that it's typically a kind of a gradual progressive decline. Vascular dementia is the other most common type of dementia that you see. And so, an individual might have a stroke or something of that nature. You tend to see a more rapid decline, but then potentially some recovery in the long run with that type of dementia.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking today about Alzheimer's or age-related dementia with Drs. Julian Keith and Len Leche, both professors of psychology at UNCW and founders of the Mars Memory Health Network. We have a good question that we'll pose to our experts when we come back from the break. 910-343-1138 is the number to call if you have a question, or email us at coastline@whqr.org. This is Coastline. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn, and I'm here with Dr. Julian Keith and Dr. Len Leche of Mars Memory Health Network. We're talking today about Alzheimer's disease in 2015, what new research is revealing about the causes of the disease and the impact of lifestyle changes. Have you served as the caretaker of a loved one with the disease? Tell us about it by calling 910-343-1138 or send an email to us at coastline@whqr.org. You can also tweet us using coastlinehqr. And we have an email from a listener who says, how much stock do you put in the idea that participating in activities such as crossword puzzles and other brain teasers can function as preventative measures for Alzheimer's? And this is an interesting question because both of you, Julian Keith and Len Leche, probably know that there is a national underwriter of NPR that, we constantly hear those underwriting promotions about brain training programs. Are those effective, and are crossword puzzles just as effective? Keith.
Okay, thank you. When there have been studies that show that when used in conjunction with other lifestyle changes, there can be benefits. Used alone, probably not much. The study that I'm thinking of was one that was done in Finland, and they had a large number of people randomly assigned to be either in a group that underwent a pretty extensive lifestyle change or a group that continued their lifestyle with just some health advice. They included in that study cognitive training, so computerized cognitive training like your underwriter provides. And they found very large benefits, very nice protective effects, but they also had people change their diets. So they went to more of the Mediterranean-style diet with nuts and oils and plant-based and low-carbohydrate-based diets. They had them exercise physically. They taught them stress reduction strategies. So they taught them to meditate and to practice relaxation skills. All of those combined dramatically decreased the risk that they would develop Alzheimer's. So,
is there a measurable difference? Do you know? And a listener actually asked me this question a year or so ago, and I looked around to see if there had been, you know, any sort of general reporting on this. And I think USA Today had published an article that said, at this point, researchers are debating the merits of these brain training programs. But so far, it looks like crossword puzzles are just as effective. Len Leite?
Well, I think that's important to note is that if, you know, we're talking about this in the context of Alzheimer's, and there's very little evidence to suggest that these are going to be your cure for Alzheimer's or that these alone will make a fundamental impact on these disorders. Where there have been some published studies showing their improvement are things like processing speed. So people do seem to get better at that. They definitely get better at those games. So kind of within that domain, there's actually been one study that came out that suggested they do a little better in their day-to-day functioning also when they perform in these. Actually impacting the memory domain, that's been one of the weakest effects. So if you think about it specifically for something like Alzheimer's, where the primary symptom is memory, you wouldn't necessarily think these approaches would be the best, since that's the one area that they probably seem to have shown the least amount of benefit on their own. But I think, you know, what Julian was getting at is what's critical is having mental engagement, forcing your brain to do new things. I mean, we do know that, you know, your brain is producing new neurons all the time, but to keep them alive, you've got to challenge them to do different things. So if you're always doing the same thing, so you mentioned crossword puzzles, you know, one might imagine that if a crossword puzzle gets easy for you and it's something you always do and you're having fun at it, at that level, it's probably not stretching you. And so, you know, trying to do something very different is likely to have more benefit for you. Now, if you've never done a crossword puzzle, the effect, at least initially, might be a little more effective for you. So it's really about challenging the brain to learn new things.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about Alzheimer's, what we know about it now, why screening is important. If you have a question or an experience you'd like to share, give us a call, 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. And Holly from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you, Holly?
Doing great, thanks.
Tell us your question. Do you have a question?
Yeah, my question has to do with the possible genetics of Alzheimer's, and is it hereditary from parent to child or grandparent to child, whatever the case may be? And given that you talked earlier about being able to change some of those things by having proper diet and exercising your body and those kinds of things, can you change that heredity if it is in fact genetic, and that, which brings me into sort of the discussion of epigenetics, genetics, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Julian Keith.
Oh, that's such a great question. That's fantastic. So there is a heritable component to Alzheimer's, particularly with the form of Alzheimer's that has an early onset that you see people in their late 50s, or actually even sometimes their 40s, 50s, early 60s, showing evidence of. And that form of Alzheimer's is rapidly progressing, and there are clear genetic markers for that, and it's highly heritable. That doesn't mean that you're necessarily going to get it if you have a relative who has it, but it means that the chances are increased. It's also likely that the later onset dementias or Alzheimer's has a heritable component as well. But
it's likely, but we don't know that yet.
We don't know as much about it. It is likely. But the question of whether that risk is modifiable through particular kinds of lifestyle interventions seems to be pretty well answered. It does look like, even if there's a heritable component, that you can decrease the likelihood of getting it by making certain lifestyle changes. You can control those risks with diet, with exercise, with learning to manage stress. The epigenetic component, now that gets pretty deep. Looking at how the activation states of genes are controlled by things like experiences with stress and other life experiences, and whether or not those are transmittable across generations. So epigenetics is a we used to always think that all the genes that we came into this world with were in a particular state, and they were not modifiable. And the discoveries in the field of epigenetics, or in the domain of epigenetics, show that you can actually change states of genes. And in some cases, those genes seem to be transferred across generations.
You can change the state of the genes that you inherit.
Exactly. So the best studies on this that I know of were done in mothers who were stressed and passed along genetic markers of having experienced that stress in the states of genes that were transmitted to their offspring. And so you can see markers of stress responsivity, too, in the offspring of mothers who were stressed. And so those kinds of things are going to be very important in our understanding of all of these kinds of diseases in the future.
Len Leachy.
And also just to point out, because I think one of the heart of the question that was being asked might be, you know, the sort of fatalistic component. So I've sort of got this genetic marker. Am I doomed? And I think it's really important for us to recognize that is absolutely not the case, not just as Julian mentioned, but also the case that we have the sort of the famous 2007 Rush study where, you know, at autopsy, you see people that have all the sort of internal markings of dementia, the Alzheimer's type, the tangles, the plaques, but they never really manifested the outward signs of it.
You're talking about things that somebody doing an autopsy would have found inside the brain.
Exactly. Okay. And so sort of the classic signs that these people really should have had dementia, the Alzheimer's type, but they didn't manifest those behaviors. And so one of the things that tells us is there's still this sort of missing link, if you will, from what's happening in the brain to these sort of functional symptoms we see in day-to-day life. And the truth is, I think, while the genetics might end up resulting in those problems in the brain, in the end, whether you have those functional symptoms, there are additional steps. That's not an automatic, even if you have, you know, some of the strongest genetic predisposing factors, it does not mean you will manifest those outward symptoms. And for all of us, I would think, that's the most important thing. It's basically your functional ability. If at autopsy they say, wow, you actually had an Alzheimer's brain, if you were able to live a good, healthy life and not really experience those consequences, that's the most important thing. And so kind of speaking to that, I think the concerns that the listener, the caller was mentioning, it's absolutely not a done deal in terms of that last step of manifesting the functional problems in day-to-day life.
Holly, thanks so much for your call. When you're talking about amyloids and tangles in the brain, is that something that can be tested for just from a physical standpoint, not a cognitive impairment standpoint, before someone passes?
The beta amyloid is the target of a lot of investigation now, and people are developing techniques to be able to use neuroimaging to see it. There's actually an effort right now to quantify it in the retina. So you can actually scan people's eyes and get a pretty good indication of how much beta amyloid there is in the brain. So there's a company right now trying to get that approved by the FDA.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about Alzheimer's research, lifestyle changes that could impact Alzheimer's in a patient. If you have a question for our guests, or if you have an experience you'd like to share, give us a call, 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org or tweet us using CoastlineHQR. Catherine, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hello there. My sister just died a year ago of frontal lobe dementia.
I'm so sorry for your loss.
Thank you. And it came on like gangbusters. The last 6 months, it just went really quickly. And when I saw her, she was walking fast, back and forth, very thin and energetic. And then she bumped her leg. They put her in a wheelchair. Then she wouldn't get up. We tried to get her up, and the brain was telling the foot not to work. And I did aromatherapy on her with frankincense and myrrh and some lavender to relax her and stop some of her agitation. And that really helped, and some foot reflexology helped, and hand therapy. And then she wasn't eating. She'd just been eating fruit, and it was hard to get food in her mouth, so I got little mini morsels, little real chocolate morsels, and I tuned them in between her lips. And the endorphins in the chocolate seemed to give her some energy, and she lifted her head up, and I saw some spark in her eye. So I just wanted to pass that along.
Catherine,
that might help.
That's so interesting. Julie and Keith Lenlechi, have there been any studies on alternative kinds of therapies to treat people with this kind of dementia?
Yeah, well, first, I wouldn't mind speaking to the frontotemporal dementia part. That's a particularly challenging situation, and I think the caller showed tremendous compassion and innovativeness and care for her sister. That's that's beautiful in itself. Frontotemporal dementia involves changes in personality and rapid changes in functional abilities, like as she described. As for alternative treatments, I think most of what we know from the alternative world comes from anecdotes, as the caller just gave. She connected with her sister. She comforted her. She was able to get her to enjoy some things, some odors and taste and being touched. Those things, I think, are very powerful. I mean, that's basic human contact. And I don't know if there's any evidence that they produced dramatic changes in the course of the disease. But I wish that everyone who had frontotemporal dementia had someone loving them the way the caller apparently loved her sister.
Catherine, thanks so much for your call. Lenlechi.
And, you know, one other thing to note when you are talking about the frontotemporal or FTD, frontotemporal dementia, often the course is different than we see with Alzheimer's. It usually advances quickly, and it also onset tends to be a little younger. The other issue that tends to come up is there's often misdiagnoses. It can appear very psychiatric. I heard Catherine give the description of a little more sometimes energetic, disinhibited sort of behavior. And so oftentimes because it's not diagnosed, it's not caught. Alzheimer's in some respects is easier to diagnose in the sense that at least the traditional case, you know, you sort of have a particular age group, the sort of classic forgetting. With the FTD, there's oftentimes that misdiagnosis, and it appears very psychiatric in its presentation.
What role does psychiatric or psychological health play in the progression of the disease? Does the level of happiness or adjustment in one's life have anything to do with this? Can it advance or slow down the progression? Lenlechi.
Great question. There's a couple of ways to come at this. One is from the standpoint of risk factors. So again, among the risk factors are certainly things like stress, depression, anxiety. Those things can be risk factors for onset of cognitive problems. So certainly treating those or avoiding those problems decreases your chances. But the other aspect of this as well is even at the level of detection, so we'll take depression as an example. When people do come to the clinic, for example, we do assess them for depression, as oftentimes with particularly more moderate to severe depression, you can have some significant memory problems that occur, but they are typically for a different reason. So the memory difficulties that occur with depression, again, are more in the inattentive component, not true memory loss information that was attained that gets lost over time. And so, again, the on the surface, a lot of these clients come in and they are complaining of memory problems, but oftentimes it's depression and it's a different type of memory difficulty that they're having, the sort of inattention. And so those are always important things to sort of separate out, both as factors for causing and sometimes some confusion, if you will, at the diagnostic level. Well.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Drs. Len Leche and Julian Keith from UNCW and Mars Memory Health Network about Alzheimer's disease, risk factors, lifestyle changes. If you have a question for our experts or a story that you'd like to share about your experience with a loved one in Alzheimer's, give us a call, 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. And we have a listener who's emailed this question: do you foresee any different healthcare models in the future that will ensure care for those that get dementia or Alzheimer's? The insurance is so expensive right now that for many it is prohibitive. I myself am having a hard time deciding whether to break my bank with monthly high payments for long-term healthcare insurance. Len Leche.
Yeah, you know, obviously that is one of the biggest. I mean, we heard some of the numbers at the outset. So it is an expensive disease. You know, Alzheimer's oftentimes doesn't kill you. You're likely to live with it for quite some time, and so it has a high toll, if you will, cost-wise, because of its durability. You might be dealing with this disease for 15, 20 years, and then the amount of support that is needed by the patient. Alternative options. We do have a lot of resources that are available in the community. Alzheimer's North Carolina is the nonprofit. We have an office right here in Wilmington, and that is certainly something we hope that everyone who has a family member that they're dealing with that has that disease would avail themselves of these free resources that are there. They do workshops for caregivers.
Tell me again the name of that nonprofit.
It's Alzheimer's North Carolina. You can find them on the web, and they're here locally, and there's full-time staff to help individuals.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Drs. Len Leche and Julian Keith about memory health, new research on Alzheimer's disease. You can ask a question of our guests by calling 910-343-1138 or emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. This is Coastline. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn, and with me in the studio once again, Drs. Julian Keith and Len Leche, UNCW professors of psychology and co-founders of the Mars Memory Health Network. We're talking about age-related dementia and Alzheimer's. If you have a question for our guests today, or if you have an experience with Alzheimer's you'd like to share, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can email us at coastline@whqr.org or tweet us using coastline@HQR. We haven't yet talked really about what Mars does and why the two of you are both enthusiastic proponents of screening, even before some of these signs, these obvious signs of Alzheimer's start to show up. Why would someone want to get screened early, Len Leche?
Well, the why part, what's critical here is, as Julie mentioned a little earlier in the show, is that our goal was to help identify people long before we're at the stage where family members can identify this individual as having memory, severe memory loss, advanced dementia. And the key for that is really because the best, interventions that are out there are really ones that, prevention by delay, essentially. They're not cures. We don't have a cure for it. And so for that reason, getting to someone very early in the process is absolutely critical. And so it makes sense if you think about it really from the standpoint of any other health condition, whether it be monitoring your blood pressure, prostate PSA levels, and mammograms, anything like this. Really, the common sense approach is when you start hitting in the risk, and remember, the number one risk for dementia of the Alzheimer's type is age. You know, we often focus on these other factors, but it's really age. This is not a disease of 10 or 20 or 30-year-olds, really. It's by and large a disease that its incidence increases dramatically when we start getting 60 and up. And so what it makes sense is as we start approaching those high-risk ages is that we begin thinking about that sort of routine, what we like to call the checkup from the neck up, right? The memory checkup. And so when you do this in a way that's proactive, that you're not waiting for the profound symptoms and your family to bring you in, but rather that you think about this as, this is something that just makes sense for me to kind of monitor, get a baseline, get a sense of where I'm functioning. And that baseline then provides us more information in order to compare scores down the road. And again, the rationale being we can catch this early, earlier we catch it, the earlier we can intervene, and the earlier we intervene, the more we can forestall the onset of the more severe symptoms down the road.
Julie and Keith, you were talking during the break. You said there are some drugs that are currently out there, not used for treating Alzheimer's, but other drugs that people take that may contribute to Alzheimer's risk. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. There are two recent studies. There were very well done studies, very carefully conducted, that showed that some of the most commonly used medications, medications for treating anxiety, like Ativan, Xanax, Valium, even Lunesta for sleep disorders and so forth, and a class of drugs called the anticholinesterases, which can include antihistamines, so drugs like Benadryl. Drugs that are taken for headaches, particularly migraines, can double your chances of developing Alzheimer's, even if you're using them only at the minimally effective dose for a period of about 3 years. So you don't want people to run out and quit taking medications their doctor has prescribed, because you know, this needs to be done under doctor supervision. But knowing that these drugs double your chances of developing Alzheimer's is a major flag that we should pay attention to. So, you know, people take Benadryl to help them sleep sometimes. When I read the study, I actually passed it along to people that I knew would take Benadryl just as a sleep aid. Because it will. It'll knock you out at night. You take a half of Benadryl and you're down for the evening. But it turns out that doing that chronically over the period of about 3 years, even at a minimal dose, doubles your risk of developing Alzheimer's.
You're listening to Coastline. It's going to take me a minute to process that. That's a staggering notion that you're not talking about increasing your risk 10 or 20%, but you're doubling your risk. You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about Alzheimer's disease, what the risk factors are, why some experts recommend early screening, and what new breakthroughs could be on the horizon. In the studio to answer your questions are Dr. Julian Keith and Dr. Len Leche. Both men are founders of Mars Memory Health Network in Wilmington. They're also both professors of psychology at UNCW. Angelo from Southport, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you. Excuse my hoarseness. I went to the Mars Memory Group in Wilmington and went through some tests because I started to feel that I was losing some memory. And eventually it led me to take a couple of sleep tests, and I was diagnosed with sleep apnea, which they indicated was one of the causes of my memory loss. I'm using a CPAP and taking preventive measures. However, will sleep apnea contribute to one getting Alzheimer's? That's my question. I appreciate your answer. Thank you.
Len Leche.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you, Angela, for the call, and thank you. What's really important also about this call, before I directly answer Angela's question, is that many times when people come in that are suffering memory difficulties, the cause of those, there are many other much more likely causes as well. So this is a great example of a case where someone comes in and might document some problem, but there are other very likely culprits. I mentioned depression earlier. Sleep apnea is certainly another one. And so to hear that this individual is correctly diagnosed and then we've sort of moved on with that treatment and it's addressing that problem, that's great. His question, though, is still important. So sleep apnea is a risk factor for dementia, the Alzheimer's type. However, by treating it effectively and getting on the CPAP, he actually brings his risk factors down to almost where they would be if he did not have it. So effective treatment, and you know, certainly knowing about CPAP, it's a real dedicated effort on individuals, you know, to continue to use the device to provide the continuous oxygen while they're sleeping. But if he is diligent about treating it, then actually his risk increase is only minimal when he is engaged in that treatment. But untreated, unfortunately, sleep apnea does increase your risk.
We were talking earlier about the exponentially increasing costs associated with the treatment of Alzheimer's disease and the increasing sector of the population that is grappling with this. Does insurance cover a screening for someone who is not showing signs of the disease?
That's a wonderful question. The way the insurance system is set up is that if there is a referral diagnosis from a primary care doctor, then it is covered by insurance. So, for example, the typical individual might have Medicare and a secondary. That would fully cover the cost of the evaluation. But there would need to be a referring diagnosis, which means the primary care physician, you know, has some suspicion of whether it's memory loss or something of that nature. With that, then it would be fully covered. If there really is no, so you have an individual who's completely healthy, they just like to establish a baseline, they have no memory risk factors, et cetera, then that would not be covered by insurance. I will say our facility, when we first opened, we established a baseline assessment to specifically target individuals who are in that latter category who might not have any of the signs that would trigger a normal referral process, but to really allow them to be tested at a pretty cost-effective rate. And so we do offer these baseline assessments for individuals, so they're non-insurance referred. The other nice piece about them is, you know, you mentioned earlier the caller talking about the long-term healthcare insurance. This would kind of stay off the radar of long-term healthcare because it's not activated in the insurance. As soon as a doctor makes a referral, of course, that is part of your official record. If you decide to come in on your own and establish a baseline, that's your own private evaluation that you would be doing. So this is sort of another added feature of that approach.
Now, we've touched on earlier a little bit the genetic nature of this, and you do not do genetic screening at Mars Memory Health Network, and there are arguments both for and against getting screened to find out if it's part of your hereditary structure. So why would someone want to get screened for that genetically?
Well, there's ethical aspects to that question. And, you know, some people like to be fully informed. The thing to remember with genetic testing is, in essence, it's giving you a probability. It is not a guarantee that you could test clean in terms of the genetics and you would have potentially still develop dementia of the Alzheimer's type. It would be what they often refer to as sporadic, non-familial version of it. You can also have the most significant risk factors genetically and never manifest the disease. So what's important really as people take a test like that is to remember that it's really giving you information on how likely you are, but not giving you information on whether you will functionally have those symptoms down the road. And so it's correct. We don't do that part. We do the functional assessment component. So,
and Julian, and with the sporadic incident. So sporadic Alzheimer's are cases where there's not a known genetic component. But the majority of cases are sporadic. So if you screened and didn't have any of the known genetic markers, you still have a risk of developing Alzheimer's.
So are you saying, Julian Keith, that most people who suffer from Alzheimer's are not suffering from it because of their genetics?
But they're not suffering from it because of known genetic markers.
Okay.
So there may be genes that are determinants of their risk that we don't know of yet. So at this point, though, most cases don't have the known genetic markers. So that raises the question, when you go in for a genetic screen, how much information are you actually getting? You haven't narrowed things down too much. If you've narrowed the probability a small amount, but you really don't have a lot of new information if you don't test as having the known markers.
Len Leite, you've talked about a recent study results. Scientists replicated Alzheimer's in a Petri dish, and you say this might even qualify as Nobel Prize-winning work. Why is that so significant?
Well, so this happened up in Massachusetts, that they were able to essentially recreate the plaques tangles essentially in a Petri dish. And one of the reasons this is a huge advancement is it allows for the very rapid testing of compounds. There's a large number of compounds that are sort of in the queue for possible drug testing down the road. But in order to sort of get to the level of human testing, which is sort of the ultimate last stage, they have to go through a series of preliminary steps and animal testing, and that can take several years to go through that. So we're really talking about an accelerated timeline now to where individuals can evaluate the effectiveness of various compounds and see the effects right, you know, in the Petri dish. And so what this is likely to do is cut significantly the time to trials, essentially more successful trials, most likely eliminating a large number of compounds and hopefully giving us a better sense of what those important compounds are. I think the implications of that work will come in the, you know, in the years to come.
When we're looking at what's out there to treat Alzheimer's right now, what do we have? And are there any drugs that are pretty effective?
There are two classes of drugs that are used to treat Alzheimer's now. One has been around for quite a long time. They're anticholinesterase drugs. They essentially keep the neurotransmitter acetylcholine at higher levels in the brain. Loss of cholinergic neurons, we call them, the neurons that manufacture and release acetylcholine, is one of the hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease. So elevating acetylcholine that's available in the brain of a person with Alzheimer's can improve functioning. There's another class of drugs that works very differently. This is going to be a hard one for your listeners to remember. They're called N-methyl-diaspartate receptor antagonists. And there's one of these that's a very low potency one that seems to work by reducing the excitability of cells. And one hypothesis about why Alzheimer's develops is that certain cells shift in their excitability profiles. They can become too excited. They overload with calcium, and then they go into this death spiral. So if you can block the calcium channels with these N-methyl-diaspartate receptor antagonists that will help keep more calcium channels closed, you protect the brain from going through that death spiral with these cells. So if you use these drugs together, cholinesterase inhibitors with these NMDA receptor antagonists, you seem to get better effects than if you use either one alone.
Len Leite.
And I think another way to think about this, especially in the light of some of the studies that have come out in the last few years, is almost to think about this as tiers of treatment. So the sort of tier one level of treatment, it's really the sort of thing probably all of us should be doing, but as you have more risk factors, you may want to think about them even more, and that's some of the dietary and lifestyle changes we discussed earlier in the show. And then, of course, as you move to the level of, all right, we are looking at sort of the earliest stages of the disease, what we often call mild cognitive impairment, the amnestic version of that. And then the very early stages of Alzheimer's, then the introduction of some of these medications makes a lot of sense as well. So sort of a two-level treatment, one that really we should all be doing and hopefully would be in very early stages for individuals who are going down the path. And then these secondary ones that would come on board, as Julie mentioned, usually starting with the cholinesterase inhibitors and then moving on and adding the cognitive neuroprotectors.
So just to be clear, we're talking about lifestyle changes, possibly preventive factors when it comes to the disease, and we just have a minute left. But what are the three most important things that people can do to stave off their risk of age-related dementia? Julian Keith.
Eat a Mediterranean-style diet. Reduce the amount of meat that you're eating. Reduce carbohydrates. Eat more plant-based. Exercise. And learn to relax. Of course, that makes people stressed out when you tell them you need to relax. But Learn to relax.
Good advice. Thank you both so much. That's this edition of Coastline, and I'd like to thank our guests, Drs. Len Leite and Julian Keith of UNCW and Mars Memory Health Network. Thanks also to you, our listeners, those of you who called and emailed. Join us for the next Coastline. We're examining foster care and foster parenting in the Cape Fear region. That's next Wednesday at 12:06 here on HQR News 91.3 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.